picture this. You're sitting in a really plush chair, right? At this massive mahogany table, okay? You hold a seat on a regional corporate board, and your day-to-day responsibility is managing critical green energy rollouts for an entire geographic sector.
Right, big stakes.
Exactly. I mean, we're talking about extensive solar installations, massive winter retrofitting pipelines, and millions, literally millions upon millions of euros in capital grants under your direct control.
Yeah, the real vital stuff, right? It is vital, life-changing work that keeps communities warm and functional. And then, you know, without a single warning klaxon, a cyber attack hits, the screens just go dark. In an absolute instant, those millions of euros are frozen in digital limbo. Vulnerable citizens are left waiting in the cold for winter upgrades that are now permanently stalled. And here's the real kicker.
What's up?
You personally and legally are on the hook.
Yeah, I mean, it is the ultimate nightmare scenario for ingovernance. You're no longer just dealing with like a broken computer server or a temporary IT outage. You are staring down the barrel of a complete regional collapse.
And that is the exact scenario we're unpacking today's deep dive. We have our hands on the facilitator notes and the incredibly detailed pre-reading material for a 2026 tabletop exercise.
Right, commonly called a TTX in the industry.
Exactly, a TTX. And this specific simulation was designed for the Southeast Energy Agency in Ireland.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case study.
It really is. So we're going to look way beyond the initial technical panic of a firewall breach. Our mission today is to explore how corporate boards actually have to handle the intense legal, financial, and public pressure of a massive cyber crisis.
And, you know, the context of the Southeast Energy Agency, or the CE, is crucial here. They are not just some isolated administrative office pushing paper around.
The materials describe them as a trusted intermediary.
They manage millions in capital grants via the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, and this is the big part. They serve as the central nervous system connecting four distinct local authorities.
Which are Carlow, Kilkenny, Wexford, and Waterford, right?
Exactly. Because they act as this central hub, a disruption to their digital ecosystem isn't just, you know, an internal problem. The damage cascades outward through the entire region.
Great. Let's unpack this regulatory trap the board is sitting in before we even get into the disaster simulation itself.
Yeah, the rules of the game have really changed.
Reading through these 2026 guidelines, it is glaringly obvious that the rules of cybersecurity have fundamentally shifted. I mean, the legal landscape is practically unrecognizable compared to just a few years ago.
Oh, absolutely. The pre-reading materials detailed the 2026 EU cybersecurity framework, and the shift is monumental.
It really is.
The cornerstone of this new reality is NIS2 directive, which was transposed into Irish law via the National Cybersecurity Bill of 2026, right?
The new bill.
Yeah, and alongside that, you still have the massive, ever-present weight of GDPR, right?
GDPR never went away.
Exactly. And what this legislation essentially does is drag cybersecurity out of the server room and drop it squarely onto the boardroom table.
So you can't just blame the IT guys anymore.
No, not at all. It is no longer acceptable to treat a hack as just an IT issue. Overseeing digital security is now a direct fiduciary duty.
And the stakes for failing that duty are just terrifying.
The documentation mentions that under NIS2, senior management is directly accountable and, in some cases, personally liable for cyber failures, right? Plus, the financial penalties are staggering.
Yeah.
We are talking about fines up to 10 million euros for essential entities under NIS2 or up to 20 million euros under GDPR.
20 million, that's just... wild, yeah. And those fines are explicitly designed to be punitive enough to bankrupt regional initiatives if necessary.
Lastly, the underlying logic of the law is to ensure that the people making the, you know, the highest level financial decisions cannot simply point the finger at their IT department when things go wrong. The regulators are forcing the board to take actual ownership.
So, it's kind of like being a bank manager, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
But instead of just guarding the physical vault inside your building, you are legally responsible for the armored cars, the public roads they drive on, and even the security systems of the local businesses receiving the cash.
That's a good way to look at it.
And if there's a pothole 3 miles down the road that causes a crash, you are personally liable.
Taking that analogy even further, the legislation explicitly mandates what they call supply chain mandates.
Okay, what does that mean in practice?
Well, think of the CEA's digital connections to those four county councils, like a shared ventilation system in a massive apartment building.
Ooh, I like this. Okay.
If one local council's network catches a virus, let's call it smoke, the central hub's network guarantees that smoke gets pumped into every other apartment unless the vents are heavily regulated and filtered.
Right, because everything is connected.
Exactly. The CEA is the hub. So, under NIS2, they legally own the risk of all those spokes.
Wow. So the board is sitting there fully aware of this massive legal and financial sword hanging over their heads, and then the simulation kicks off, right? But it doesn't start with a literal bang. It's a silent freeze across the entire network. And it's the absolute peak of the grant application cycle.
Of course it is. Suddenly, ransomware hits. Yeah, and the specific target is the CEA's ISO 50001 cloud environments.
Which, basically, they're energy auditing databases. They are entirely locked down by an external threat actor.
Gotcha. ISO 50001 is the international gold standard framework for managing energy data. So hitting that system paralyzes their core operational metrics. The data linkages to the local authorities and the national authority are actively compromised.
The facilitator notes detailing the behavioral dynamics of the participants in the room are just fascinating to me.
Oh, they're so telling. The very first instinct that grips the board is what the exercise calls the unplug everything reflex, right? The representatives from the local councils, Carlow, Kilkenny, Wexford, Waterford, they immediately demand the total isolation of their specific county networks. We want to cut the shared VPN lines and the shared mapping data just to save themselves from the infection.
It's pure panic. But wait, I have to challenge the premise of the simulation.
Okay, go for it.
Isn't the unplug everything reflex actually the smartest move you can make?
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Right, because if my ship is taken on water, I am shutting the watertight doors immediately to save whatever compartments I can. Why are the facilitator notes framing this natural self-preservation instinct as a, you know, friction point?
Well, it is a very natural assumption to make in the heat of the moment. However...
But I'm wrong.
Well, a little bit. The difference between an isolated IT incident and a systemic regional crisis lies in the physical mechanics of the infrastructure.
Okay, how so?
While immediate isolation sounds like basic triage, total and instantaneous decoupling destroys business continuity across the entire region. The expert analysis in the scoring rubric points out that blindly severing all ties panics the public and stops all regional operations completely cold.
Okay, I see the flaw in my logic now.
If you shut all the watertight doors, nobody can actually access the engine room or the bridge to steer the ship.
Exactly. You might not sink immediately, but you're just trapped in a floating box drifting toward the rocks.
That is the exact trap boards fall into. A high-performing team has to balance containment with keeping the region running, which is incredibly hard.
Barry, they need to secure specific pathways rather than just taking an axe to the physical cables. And while the board is arguing about severing these connections, the simulation forces them into their next major bottleneck, which is the notification dilemma, right? The dreaded 72-hour clock. Under GDPR regulations, the moment an organization is aware of a personal data breach, a strict 72-hour countdown begins.
Right. Within that window, you must notify the Data Protection Commission, or the DPC.
But here's the catch. The board doesn't even know what is actually happening yet, right? The notes say the participants are struggling to separate verified facts from wild assumptions.
It's just chaos. The risk and legal team is screaming to wait. They argue they need the forensics team to map the breach because a false alarm to the DPC triggers massive uninvited audits and scrutiny, and you do not want that.
Meanwhile, the communications lead is in an absolute panic that this data leak is going to hit the local media before the board even issues a basic holding statement.
And this is where the physics of the situation clash with the law. The physical mechanics of a cyber investigation dictate that forensics teams need days, sometimes weeks, to definitively map how a threat actor moved through a network.
Wow, weeks easily. But the law demands a report in 3 days. The legal instinct is to say nothing until every single fact is bulletproof, which makes sense from a liability standpoint.
Sure, but the PR instinct is to say something immediately so the organization doesn't look like it's covering up a disaster. If you wait too long to reconcile those two instincts, you breach that 72-hour statutory window and those massive 20 million euro fines come into play. This actually ties into a
detail in the facilitator notes about the official board decision logs, which I found incredibly revealing about human psychology in a crisis.
Oh, the voting splits.
Yes. The notes say that high-performing teams will consistently show unanimous votes when it comes to technical network isolation or authorizing manual payment bridges. Everyone readily agrees on stopping the technical bleeding.
Unanimous across the board.
But those same high-performing teams naturally show majority splits. Not unanimous votes, but fractured ones on exactly when to notify the public.
And, you know, a split vote on public notification is not a sign of a dysfunctional board.
It's not. No, it is the signature of a healthy, rigorous debate. It perfectly reflects that real-world tension we just outlined.
The push and pull, exactly. You have the intense tug of war between the legal caution of waiting for verified forensic facts and the public accountability of wanting to be transparent with citizens.
That makes total sense. If everyone in the boardroom instantly agrees on exactly when to talk to the press during a chaotic crisis, someone is fundamentally failing to advocate for their department's specific risk profile.
Though the board is paralyzed trying to figure out if they should unplug the servers, and they are completely split on when to call the press, right? But while they're debating these IT and PR protocols, the real-world consequence hits. The accounting and grant management systems rely on those exact same locked server environments. Which brings us to the financial freeze.
And this is where the simulation pivots from a digital headache to a tangible real-world emergency.
Oh man, the stakes go way up, way up. Over 20 million euros in pending regional grant funding and capital projects are halted mid-transaction due to compliance holds on the compromised network.
20 million just frozen in midair. The downstream effects are absolutely devastating. You have commercial contractors who suddenly cannot make payroll for their crews.
Oh man!
You have community groups who were promised funding to start construction, now left completely hanging. And it gets worse. Most emotionally, you have vulnerable elderly residents who were scheduled for urgent winter retrofits like insulation, new heating systems, who are now stuck waiting in the cold because the entire capital pipeline is frozen solid.
I mean, this completely shifts my perspective on the actual threat of ransomware.
How so? Well, the ransom demand itself, like paying the hacker in cryptocurrency, isn't even the primary financial threat here.
Exactly. The real threat is the collateral damage of stopped commerce. It's like a massive traffic jam on a major national supply route.
That's a great analogy. The traffic jam causes millions of euros in lost goods and spoiled freight, which ends up costing the economy exponentially more than the two crashed cars that originally caused the jam.
And the scale of that collateral damage triggers what the facilitator notes call the CNI awakening. Right, because of the facilitator's opening script about the frozen retrofits, it dawns on the room that if the regional building retrofits stop, and the local green energy inputs stall, the broader grid management calculations fail.
It's all connected to the national grid. Exactly. Our grid and the ESB physically rely on that regional energy data to balance the national power load. The CE suddenly realizes they are a critical bottleneck for the entire country's energy security.
And as the sheer scale of this realization hits the room, the local media starts reporting on the multi-million euro project delays.
Predictably, the local authority representatives start getting frantic phone calls from their respective county managers, who are demanding that they issue localized statements to calm down their specific local businesses. Every county suddenly wants to speak for themselves.
And the scoring rubric is exceptionally rigid on this point. Oh yeah, very. The board chairperson must aggressively step in and enforce the single voice rule.
The single voice rule, yes. They have to stop the board from speaking with fractured, contradictory voices. All inquiries, regardless of which county they originate from, must route to a single central CEO crisis press room.
Wait, why is that rule so rigid though? I mean, wouldn't a localized update from the Carlo representative naturally comfort the Carlo contract more effectively than some sterile regional press release?
It sounds good in theory, but in a cyber incident of this scale, mixed messaging is actively weaponized by the attackers.
Weaponized? How?
If one county releases a statement saying, "We are completely secure," and another county simultaneously says, "We are evaluating a ransom demand," you broadcast a narrative of total internal chaos.
Oh, I see.
Furthermore, the rubric strictly docks points if any board member publicly confirms their ransom details or speculates on the identity of the threat actor. Why is that?
Doing so compromises the active forensic investigations being run by the National Cybersecurity Center. It fuels community panic, validates the attacker's methods, and practically invites copycat attacks.
You essentially put a massive neon price tag on your own back.
Exactly. You have to project a calm, unified authority. The recommended approach is to acknowledge a, quote, network service interruption and confirm that authorities are involved without feeding the media frenzy with unverified technical details.
Okay, so with the region on the brink of financial and infrastructural gridlock, how do they actually govern through this?
That is a big test, because if I am sitting on this board, I am realizing we cannot just sit around waiting for the IT team to fix a firewall. We have to somehow keep the region alive while the computers are basically dead. How are they legally allowed to bypass these frozen digital pipelines to pass the test?
To succeed, the board has to deliver a 4-point strategic response directive.
Okay. This is the mechanism by which they prove they are capable of legislating a path out of the crisis rather than just panicking. The 4 pillars of this directive are legal, financial, communications, and post-incident resilience.
Let's dive deep into the mechanics of those pillars, because the logistical solutions high-performing teams develop are just brilliant.
They really are. On the financial side, tackling that frozen 20 million euros, they implement something called the Paper Bridge Protocol.
Yes, the Paper Bridge Protocol. The irony is just incredible to me. It shows that sometimes the absolute best, most highly effective cybersecurity response is literally returning to physical pens and paper.
The logistics of the Paper Bridge Protocol are a perfect example of pragmatic governance.
How does it actually work? They authorize a temporary manual verification framework with the national authority using secure offline pathways. Because the cloud is locked and completely untrusted, the board mandates the use of dual signed PDFs carried over insulated localized networks and sometimes even physical paper.
Yeah, in some cases, the creation of literal paper trails via courier to Dublin. They manually bypass the locked digital infrastructure entirely to process those urgent, high-priority grants. That's what keeps the local contractor solvent and the winter retrofits moving.
The physical reality of a modern, heavily digitized office suddenly having to, like, locate a working offline printer, physically sign a document, hand it to a courier, and drive it across the country just to process a routine grant is mind-boggling.
It is quite the mental image. It's like manually cranking the massive gears of a ship when the electronic engine software completely fails.
Exactly, and they pair that physical workaround with an incredibly smart legal maneuver.
Yeah, invoking force majeure, yes. The board issues a formal, legally binding resolution invoking force majeure clauses specifically for the Act of Sustainable Energy Community Projects.
And what does that do? The underlying mechanism here is liability protection. Those local contractors are bound by contracts with strict deadlines for carbon reduction timelines.
Right, they have to hit their targets. By formally recognizing the cyber attack as an unforeseeable act of God, the board legally shields the community contractors from being sued or penalized for missing those critical deadlines due to the frozen funds.
That is the exact definition of strong governance. It really is. They're using their legal authority to create a protective umbrella for the people on the ground who are actually doing the vital work.
They realize their job isn't to decrypt the ransomware. Their job is to manage the liability and ensure the survival of their region.
And that brings us to the fourth pillar, post-incident resilience.
Because the crisis doesn't end when the computers turn back on. Exactly. Because once the immediate fire is extinguished and the systems are decrypted, you still have a compromised, burned-down house to deal with. This is perhaps the most critical long-term lesson of the entire tabletop exercise.
A resilient board doesn't just try to return to the old way of doing things, right? They don't just reboot the servers and pretend it didn't happen.
Returning to normal is actually considered a failure in the simulation. Wow, yeah. The board has to recognize that their old architecture was the systemic risk in the first place. The deliverables mandate that they commit substantial capital budget to completely fix it. They must mandate a zero-trust network redesign.
Okay, let's clarify what zero trust actually means in practice, because it sounds a bit like industry jargon.
Fair point. So the old model of cybersecurity was the castle and moat approach.
Okay, if you had the password to get past a firewall, the moat, the system trusted you to wander around anywhere inside the castle.
Long as you're in, right? Zero trust literally means the network does not blindly trust a user or a data packet just because they are already inside the system.
Oh, I get it. Every single request for data at every single junction has to be continuously authenticated. It's like having a security guard checking your ID at every single door inside an office building, not just at the front gate.
So, moving forward, any shared data pathways with the four county councils will require strict identity verification at every single touchpoint.
Precisely. And the notes also mention directing the decoupling of the ISO 5001 energy auditing database from the main financial pipeline.
Yes, that physical separation of those systems ensures that if a threat actor manages to breach the energy data again, they cannot laterally cross over and paralyze the money.
Oh, right. You're basically building structural bulkheads into the ship so that one localized leak does not sink the entire vessel.
That's incredibly smart. And finally, they must partner directly with AirGrid to map out exactly how their localized data impacts the national infrastructure, ensuring they are never a blind spot for the country's grid management.
Again, it really emphasizes how multidimensional this all is. Cybersecurity in this modern regulatory era is clearly no longer about just updating antivirus software.
Not at all. It's about governance. It's about fiduciary duty, legal liability, and managing massive systemic risks that bleed into the real world.
The fundamental shift in corporate responsibility cannot be overstated here. If your organization is targeted tomorrow, the regulators, the media, and the public will not just ask what the IT department did to stop the code, right? They don't care about the code. They will demand to know exactly what the board of directors did to prepare, to mitigate, and to govern through the resulting chaos.
So, for everyone listening, I want you to reflect on this dynamic. Do the organizations you rely on, whether it is your local council, your bank, or the very company you work for, do they treat cyber threats as an annoying localized IT headache, or do they treat them as a strategic, systemic boardroom priority?
It's a question because, as we have seen today, the cost of getting that answer wrong is absolutely staggering. And as we look at the tension between these massive EU green initiatives and the stringent new cyber laws, there's a complex reality to consider.
What's that? Well, as we rapidly transition to smart grids, interconnected solar arrays, and hyper-connected regional infrastructure to hit our vital carbon targets, are we inadvertently building an ecosystem where a single compromised password could stall our entire fight against climate change?
Wow, that is a chilling thought to leave on. We are building the interconnected future, but we have to ensure the foundation can withstand the pressure. Think back to that boardroom we started in. The screens are dark, the money is frozen, the clock is relentlessly ticking, and the entire region is waiting for an answer. When that moment comes, you can't just unplug the cable and hide. You have to lead. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.